Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Hey, folks. I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
The book is called The KLF, The Band Who Burned a Million Pounds. And the KLF were like a...
I remember them.
Yeah. So the KLF made...
Justified and Ancient.
Yeah, exactly. They had some big early electronic hits in the late 80s, early 90s in the UK. And at the height of their fame, the two guys took out £1 million, almost all their money, took out £1 million from their bank account, went to a deserted Scottish island with a journalist who had a camcorder, and they burned it all. They burned £1 million. They burned it. It took like over an hour. They didn't tell anyone for multiple months. And then they began doing screenings in art galleries around the UK where they would screen this film of them burning like 20 pound note after 20 pound note over the course of an hour. First time anyone knew that they had done this, they would show this video and then they would ask the audience, why did we do this? And it was like a genuine question.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Hey, it's Srini. So I just want to tell you how much I appreciate the fact that you're listening to the show. And if you found the podcast fascinating, instructive, inspiring, or maybe even heartwarming, if there's one person you could think of who'd appreciate our show, a friend or a family member, take a moment and share the show with them, because good ideas are meant to be shared. Yancey, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I actually came across your work by way of your publicist who sent me your book. I know you're the co-founder of Kickstarter, which we will talk about. But when I picked up This Could Be Our Future, I thought, wow, this is one of these books that I couldn't put down. It was... I loved the idealism. I loved the optimism. And then I also had moments of doubt, like, is this possible? All of which we will get into. Before we get into that, I want to ask you what I think is a very relevant question to frame this. And that is, what is the earliest memory that you have or earliest imprint you remember growing up about money that you got from your parents?
Earliest, hard to say, but you know, I grew up lower middle class. My parents divorced when I was three, but my dad was a traveling waterbed salesman, and my mom was a secretary at a local college at a school nearby. And I was aware of like money being an issue. It wasn't like going hungry or anything like that, but we definitely lived a very modest life, and I was always very aware that money was a real limitation, and that wasn't hidden from me. I would say I've largely felt kind of fearful of money. Generally whenever money would come up, I can't recall it ever being in a positive context. It was always one of fear and of lacking. And that really colored my experience through high school, through college. You know, I moved to New York after college and became a music critic. Which also that did not change my financial standing in any way. I remember when I was maybe I was close to 30 was the first time I made like more than $50,000 in a year. And, I think of money as being a struggle and really not something that I was ever particularly adept at because I had more of a fear of it than like, wanting to go towards it. But I remember when I first made over 50 grand and first felt like some level of solidity for the first time. And it was, oh my goodness, it was night and day, you know, it made a huge difference, but there was a part of me that was all, I just assumed that this was temporary and that I would fall back to where I'd been. And I think I really only stopped assuming that would be the case, you know, maybe in the last 5 or 6 years of my life.
What changed? How did you stop assuming that would be the case? Because I can relate. I'm absolutely in that exact same situation. You know, I just finished writing two books with the publisher. And in my mind, I'm like, wow, am I ever going to get back to that same sort of level of, you know, status again in terms of accomplishment?
And at the same time, I'm kind of like, okay, I know that there's this emptiness that comes with accomplishment, which we'll talk about, because I know you wrote about life goals and I want to definitely talk about that. But what changed? Like, how did that change? Was it just because of the success of Kickstarter, or did something shift internally?
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, one is, I think in so many ways, and what you look for in love and what makes you comfortable, like, you know, childhood sets it just creates an imprint that you then consider normal, right? So normal to me up until, you know, for the first 30 years of my life was of like struggle and looking at your bank account, you have to like really swallow hard and be prepared before you look. And so probably it was like having 5 or 6 years of not having that experience. You know, Kickstarter, we, you know, didn't guide it towards a personal financial outcome. Like, we didn't create the company to sell it or to try to cash out for ourselves. And in fact, as the co-founders of the company, we were all very clear that we didn't want to do that, that we didn't see that as being success. And that was not something that we were eager for. So, you know, definitely Kickstarter provided a level of security. And by creating something that had real meaning in the world that also like is a business, just, I think, allowed me to feel like I have, like, there's finally a foundation here, you know, there's a foundation here after my family. Yeah. And then probably even having my own family, getting married, having a child, you know, that also made me like we're very budget conscious. We have a weekly budget and like really like working with that kind of discipline. Because now I feel, you know, now that I'm not just having to think about myself, you know, I've forced myself to become responsible. You know, I forced myself to do the things I didn't want to do, and have to create tools and structures to help me do that, because I know on my own, part of me is still like the little boy that just, you know, just hates when anyone brings up money, because I just know it's going to lead to a stressful outcome.
Mm-hmm. I can relate. I feel like I've had relationships end because of my money situation. I've had, you know, tension with other people because of my money situation. It's one of those things that I just felt was, you know, it's a strange thing, you know, in the world we live in. And I think it's a real, to me, like I said, it's a really relevant question given the subject matter of the book. But one thing I wonder is that your narrative here is kind of an anomaly in the world of technology startups, where, you know, investors throw down money and the expectation is, okay, this money is going to produce some sort of return. I know this because we just raised a round of venture funding. In my mind, I thought, all right, there's one thing I'm thinking about here is how do I make sure I get them a positive return on this investment? And that, you know, that makes me nervous too.
Yeah.
But you guys are an anomaly in that you kind of have basically gone against the grain when it comes to this narrative.
Yeah. And, well, when, you know, I guess, it's like you signed a post-dated check when you took that money, right?
Yeah.
And you know it, but you don't really know it. And you won't feel what the reality of that is. You know, the expectation set for the financial backing of whatever your project is, the expectations those set will ultimately kind of make every decision for you for the foreseeable future. You won't know that. And there'll still be a question of how, like, what is the path to get to this outcome? Yeah. But it essentially puts you in a place of you must prioritize growth and margins and profit margins.
Yeah.
And you're free to play around and do all your cute things. You know, you're free to virtue signal on the internet all you want to. But in the end, what matters is your growth rates and your margins. And, you know, so that's how institutional money thinks, because it's simply looking at the rate of return. You know, I think it was of the co-founders, you know, Perry Chen who first had the idea for Kickstarter. And I think he was the one that had just like the greatest personal suspicion of what kind of requirements, what strings would come with money.
Yeah.
For Charles and I, also co-founders of Kickstarter, you know, we both came from like music backgrounds and just, you know, just aren't people that are geared that way. Weren't looking for those outcomes. I'm like, you know, I loved Fugazi and things like that in high school. So to me, like being punk rock and never selling out is just like something that I was taught in a very deep way. And so, but you know, the kind of the beauty of Kickstarter, one of the many beauties of it, but is that, you know, we didn't raise a lot of money. The site was funded with not a lot of money, and the site was profitable early on because we really focused on that. We didn't grow too much. We didn't try to let growth drive further growth.
Yeah.
Where you get locked in these loops that you have to fulfill.
Right.
Instead, it was like, Yeah, exactly. And instead, we were in a position where we just always had maximum optionality. We could do what we wanted. We were in control of our destiny. And we just thought that is the situation that will let us make the best decision, you know, the most often. Now, that doesn't mean you always do. And there's ways that pressure from investors can be helpful. But when the only acceptable outcome, the only acceptable outcome of a project is a financial outcome for somebody else.
Yeah.
I don't know. To me, that sparks a lot of like existential questions that really lower my drive to do something in that area. And so Kickstarter, works a different way.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, part of my thought process was, you know, okay, look, this was one of those things where we were kind of like, okay, we're going month to month and every like little thing is a make or break moment where it's just terrifying. We're not able to think longer term about this. And I think that was the one thing. It kind of, you know, you mentioned peace of mind. I think it gave me the peace of mind to know that, okay, you know what? I can make longer term decisions now because the lifeline has been extended significantly. You have a bigger runway. So that's one way I think about it. But I totally get where you're coming from because I it's like a strange paradox, right? At the same time, I still have to deal with exactly what you're talking about.
Well, you know, it's I'm sure there's a story that you tell yourself, and it's true to some significant degree that like, hey, the Unmistakable Creative Podcast being the single biggest media platform in the world would be a great thing for the world. And so like that signing up to that as my goal is not just for me, it's for everybody. Think of all the ways people will be more empathic and, you know, more thoughtful, et cetera. Like that, that's a story that we could tell. Yeah. And you know, it's a nice story. The reality is probably doing that means like, you know, you're maybe compromising things that you didn't think that you would have to compromise on.
Oh yeah.
But there is the case for some businesses where that is true, you know? So like Kickstarter, it's like helping creative projects get out into the world. We didn't want to help charitable projects. We thought that should be a different site. And it did end up being a different site, GoFundMe. And we wanted to create a certain vibe in a certain space. And so that necessitates a lot of like kind of indie rock choices about how you build your business. But, you know, I'm advising a startup now called REN, Project REN, W-R-E-N. That's like a monthly subscription carbon offsetting service. Mm-hmm. You put in your carbon calculator, you then I pay $40 a month to plant and protect trees in Ethiopia and Brazil. Wow. And so that's a business that I love working with them. They're amazing entrepreneurs. But I'm like, I will tell you how to do certain things, but ultimately like your job is to be as big as possible. Yeah. You know, like like Kickstarter's goal of like, let's be as meaningful as possible to the right number of people is right for that product. But something like a carbon offsetting subscription service, I'm like, you need to be as mass as possible. You know, I don't know that there's any other way to think about success.
Yeah.
Well, so and everyone thinks they're that special case. I think few things actually are, but that is the story we tell ourselves.
Well, I love that because, you know, it's something that, you know, I think a lot about. And one of the commitments I always made is I said, I will never make a guest choice based on what I think that person would do for our downloads. Like I've turned down people who are extremely well known that everybody listening has heard of, mainly because I just didn't feel they were aligned with our values. And that to me and that's served us well. In fact, some of the most unknown people often end up being our most provocative and interesting guests. But we've done that at the cost of metrics at times.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the right you want to have, you know, and that's something that just gets more complicated over time. The size of the organization changes. And, you know, what's funny is even when like the DNA of a company is set a certain way, the founders, like even in Kickstarter, the founders see it a certain way, how the staff or members of the team may feel may be completely different, you know? And so actually sometimes you get pushed by people internally saying, hey, why don't we try to grow more? Why don't we try launching this product that I think will really like move the numbers? And someone will have a great argument. And then it's hard when the response is, yeah, but that's, you know, if we think about where we ultimately want to end up, I don't think it's there. Right. Yeah. Like, is that a path towards our ultimate destination? Or is that something that's going to possibly take us away from that? If it's the latter, then no matter how good the idea is, we shouldn't do it because, you know, you earn trust and you build a brand through that long-term predictability of just making the same decisions day after day. And on a daily basis, it feels completely not rewarding. It feels not rewarding. Mm-hmm. It feels like you're losing because every day you're seeing, you know, press releases of companies and other people doing new things. And you're like, oh man, we got to, what are we doing? What's the new thing? You know, yeah. And you feel this pressure. But really, it's like doing the same thing over a long period of time. It becomes meaningful the longer you do it. It's quite strange. Uh-huh. It's quite strange.
Yeah. I mean, I can relate. We've been at this for 10 years. So one of the things that I want to talk about is music. You've alluded to it a couple of different times during our conversation. And I think that, you know, I want to talk about that and briefly about projects on Kickstarter and then get into the content of the book. But what influence did music end up having on the choices that you made after your time in music? Like what, you know, what did you take away from that that you've applied going forward?
Well, yeah, I spent like 10 years or so as a music journalist. I'd started a little record label at a place I worked. You know, that was what I was most passionate about. Still is one of my probably three or four biggest passions. You know, I mean, that definitely informed how I thought about Kickstarter, where, you know, I was working in the digital music industry in like the early 2000s. So at that time, the crisis was Napster and like no one's going to pay for music anymore. And, which was an important conversation, but what I just kept thinking about was like, well, nobody's thinking about like how this music gets made in the first place. Like for how, where's the artist getting money to make the thing? And what if it's not going to be a hit? And like, everyone was just sort of imagining that there's this natural steady state flow of great music that was just automatically going to happen. It was just a matter of like how much they could sell of it and where. And to me, it just felt it was like a businessman's way of thinking about the music industry rather than a musician's way of thinking about it. So, you know, it just led me to have an even just more and more of alignment with artists, with musicians. And, you know, as a critic, that's a funny thing to have because it's often an antagonistic relationship. You know, you're as a critic, you're like using the musician as a platform to show how smart you are. Often that's like many of my reviews ultimately boiled down to that, like very not glorious goal. But you know, the other thing I took from music is that when I went full time into Kickstarter, I had real mixed feelings about it because music had defined me. Being a musician, being a writer had defined me. And I really worried about becoming, in my mind, just a businessman. And like that felt like a real sellout. That felt like losing a part of myself. And I just didn't know. I don't know. I was like more nervous about that than really seems in any way reasonable or appropriate. But you know what? I found that like, 3 months after I'd stopped working in music and was like working on Kickstarter, I was intellectually stimulated, but also I ended up loving music way more than ever before. You know, I spent like the whole year after I stopped being a critic, I only listened to this Fleetwood Mac record Tusk, which is a great record, but I like only listened to that for a year because in the past, you know, my job was to write about whatever the new thing is and to get out the first review. And so you're just churning through stuff at such a crazy rate to where nothing is meaningful. Like none of the music is meaningful. And so then like this ultimate rebellion of, I get to just go away and spend time with kind of a maligned record from the 70s for a year and just go deep with something that had no cultural meaning, except as like a work of music. And that put me on a great path with music again. I mean, I play music every day. I listen to it all the time. It's like you know, I don't listen to a lot of podcasts because I think that I need to save that time for music. Cause like, that's like my spirituality, you know?
It's funny. I don't listen to a lot of podcasts and I host one. So
Podcasts are the internet for your ears. That's like, I'm like, sometimes I just need to go away from that.
Hey, it's Srini. So I've recently put together a new free guide on how to build an audience for your work. And in this guide, you'll learn how to create consistently, regardless of how much time you have. You'll learn the biggest mistake every creator makes when they're building their audience, how to get from zero to your first few readers, and you'll get a sneak preview of the material in my upcoming Loyal Audience Mastermind program. So just visit unmistakablecreative.com/build to sign up and get this guide for free. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/build. So let's talk briefly about the people who launch projects on Kickstarter, because I think often about some of the things that Seth Godin has said about Kickstarter. You know, you probably heard him say this. He said it should really be called Kick Finisher, because I think that there's a sort of delusion in my mind that people think that the success of their projects on Kickstarter is based on, attention from strangers on the internet. And yet, if you look at the people, at least, you know, in the circles that I've run in and the guests that I've had, almost all of them had an existing audience that helped to fuel their Kickstarter projects. So I wonder, you know, as the co-founder, like, what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, if the Kickstarter project is your first step in something, you know, I think that's an issue. Like, it's a conversion of loyalty, trust, and love into fuel for the next project. And if you haven't earned a lot of that trust, loyalty, or love, it's going to be harder. But you know, of course, we all want to believe. You know, we just all want to believe our biggest dreams. I mean, who can help it? You know, it's like we look. You know, I look at tweets on Twitter that have thousands of retweets, and you know, I'm like, all right, how do I do one of those? You know, how do I do one of those? And then you like look, and the person has like 60,000 followers, and you're like, okay, so I have to do that first, okay? And but you know, there's this, you're just like, how do I? You know, I'm smart. I'm, you know, I have good ideas. Why can't I do that? And so, it's a human trait. You know, I think that. The process, like the UI, the messaging, the sort of the instructions you're giving and building a project, try to prepare you for this. Try to give you a sense of what's ahead of you. And it's not, you know, it's not easy. So there is just a natural filter that happens. Yeah. But, you know, there is some significant portion, you know, somewhere between 10 and 20% of projects that don't end up getting a single backer. And it's because people are doing it with this reason, right? They're just like, well, if I put it there, something good's going to happen, right? And sometimes that does happen, but those That's who rare. Count on it, you know, it's sorry. Sorry well, about that.
Yeah, so I look at that and, you know, I mean, obviously Patreon kind of, I think, was a follow-up to you guys in terms of supporting artists, but I look at Patreon and I mean, I look at the internet in general, and I think that the internet literally mirrors America. Like, you've got sort of the 1% and everybody else when it comes to creative projects on the internet. Like, a small swath of companies get the bulk of the traffic on the internet. A small group of creators get the bulk of like supporters. A small group of authors make, you know, cause the bulk of book sales. And so, you know, I think that, you know, you open the book, and I think this actually makes a perfect segue by saying execution is a critical gap between idea and reality, but it's not the only one. Another is belief. For ideas to matter, people have to believe in them. There's only so much an idea can do on its own. Ideas need supporters, carriers, and executors to become real. And I think that there's no shortage of people who believe in their own ideas. The question is, how do you bridge the gap between people who believe in their own ideas and getting other people to believe in them?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of one of the ultimate competitions at this moment in time. Yeah. And a lot of that is like, you know, the container you express it in, you know, dictates a lot of that. You know, it was clear to me that I, you know, the only way to share the things I was thinking about would be in a book. And, you know, a book felt like, it's like the minimum viable real thought, you know, like anything. And, you know, what is any article ever meant to me? You know, sure, there are some like philosophical essays that have meant a lot to me, but, you know, there's just, I think for an idea to really earn its way into your thinking, you need to live inside of it. You know, you need to live with it. You need to breathe it in. And so I was just very clear on the form that this would take. And I was, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking about the outcome I desired from the book and before I started writing it. And there were sort of two outcomes I thought about. One was that people would walk away, and this is, you know, people would walk away with a specific kind of feeling, a feeling like they were seeing the world in a different way than they'd seen it before. But like there was this emotional spark I wanted people to experience. And it's one that I write about in the book. It's a similar spark that I felt of just watching Kickstarter happen. It was initially terrifying to me because I couldn't believe that just something that, you know, the three of us are working on that Perry had made up was just like suddenly working and people were just using it. And I was just waiting for like the person in charge to come give us our official paperwork to say we were approved to like change the world in this way.
Yeah.
And the fact that things were so wide open was really alarming to me. And then over time it felt empowering. And so I'm trying to create a similar kind of journey, an emotional journey for people. And then, you know, I was also really influenced by, there's this book by a writer named John Higgs And it's, the book is called The KLF, The Band Who Burned a Million Pounds. And the KLF were like a...
I remember them.
Yeah. So the KLF made...
Justified and Ancient.
Yeah, exactly. They had some big early electronic hits in the late 80s, yeah. early 90s in the UK. And at the height of their fame, the two guys took out £1 million, almost all their money, took out £1 million from their bank account, went to a deserted Scottish island with a journalist who had a camcorder, and they burned it all. They burned £1 million. They burned it. It took like over an hour. They didn't tell anyone for multiple months. And then they began doing screenings in art galleries around the UK where they would screen this filming, this film of them burning like 20-pound note after 20-pound note over the course of an hour. First time anyone knew that they had done this, they would show this video and then they would say, they would ask the audience, why did we do this? And it was like a genuine question.
Mm.
And they became like the most vilified people in the world, as you can imagine, because it's like, you know, Elton John spending £1 million a year on flowers was productive, but then burning £1 million is like the most, you know, the most offensive thing possible. So John Higgs writes this amazing book about this story. And what he ends up saying is that he believes that they were speaking, they were trying to communicate with something that Alan Moore called the idea space. And Alan Moore says that just as there's a physical world, there's a chemical world, there's a spiritual world, there's also an ideas world, a place where ideas natively live. And we imagine this idea space, we have an image of it, of as like thought bubbles above our heads, and that's kind of right. But what we don't realize is that the thought bubbles above our heads have doors, and that our ideas will leave our minds, and they will interact with other minds in like the idea space and the boulevards and parks of the idea space. And that it's also possible for an idea to create itself in the idea space and then enter a human's mind. And that it doesn't originate inside our own brains, but actually comes from somewhere else, and then we become the carriers for it. And so John Higgs thinks that this choice of burning £1 million was the idea space speaking through the KLF, trying to express to them like what the ultimate sacrifice would be, what the ultimate statement would be, what would be the most meaningful thing to do, which was to burn all of their money. And that would produce some meaningful response. And I was really struck by this, how John Higgs writes about the idea space and the sense of how things work. And it felt very true to me. And so I was imagining my book as trying to speak to the idea space, trying to speak to like, imagining like Luke going into the Death Star and trying to find that deepest vulnerable point, that one spot where like the truth is still exposed. And how do I poke that point? And how do I put like a drop of red in that reservoir and shift how we think? And so I like, that was a real image I had in my mind every day, putting a drop of red in the reservoir. And I wanted it to have an emotional response for people. So I there was just like this shape, this color, this feeling that I could sense would matter. And that and because I could see it, it was my responsibility to try to execute it. And every day I was just trying to like, just trying to brush aside the dust and carve that out.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this, you're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Well, one of the things that you hit on over and over and over in the book, which I think for good reason based on the content, is this whole idea of financial maximization. You say, you know, financial maximization says that in any decision, the rational choice is the one that makes the most money. This is the underlying why behind many of our choices. And you also say that it's a never-ending search for cost to cut and value to extract. Even in periods of success, its only move is the downside to downsize people and redistribute money to shareholders. There's no vision for anything else. And you really go, I think, deeper into this idea in this whole chapter about the mullet economy, which you talk about the maximizing class, the end of raises, you know, competition, layoffs. So one, could you expand on that for us? And then, you know, in the context of the fact that we're literally on the eve of another election, how do you think about it, you know, from that standpoint, from a political standpoint?
Yeah. I write the theme of the first half of the book is this, as you said, financial maximization, the idea that the rational choice in every decision is whichever option makes the most money. And, you know, I show how that has like shaped our choices. And one of the things I really want people to understand is that this hasn't always been there, that this is something that I contend really came to pass in the early 1970s. And one of the ways I give evidence of this is showing that from 1945 until 1973, the average American worker got a 90% raise, and it was the lowest paid workers who got the biggest raises. And then starting in 1973, the way that companies began to operate really changed. And we can see this, one of the most striking places is in worker pay, where adjusted for inflation since 1973, the average American worker has gotten a 10% raise. So it's like a 90% raise up until 1973. And then there's this record scratch moment where people stop getting raises. And if you look at it, the productivity of the American worker has continued to increase. So it wasn't like they were doing less. And this means that the high point for pay for productivity for the American worker was 73, the same year Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon came out. But I talk about how the shape that's been created by this is what I call the mullet, where you know, the mullet is business in front, as the hairstyle is business in front, party in the back. And so where we've ended up is that for 90% of people, life is business in front with frozen wages, layoffs, and like extreme job insecurity. And then it's the party in the back for the top 1%, where since the same time workers have gotten a 10% raise, the bosses have gotten a 1,000% raise, and stock buybacks are just through the roof. So what's crazy is you say, well, if this is true, if workers have only gotten a 10% raise since 1973, then how can that possibly be true? Look at the world around us. Look at how much more money is floating around. How could this be the case? And this is where you see the shift in strategy, because in the past, companies would give people raises. They would redistribute wealth to workers who helped make it. And then what changed in 1970 was the invention of something called the credit card. In the up until the 1960s, there was zero credit card debt in the United States. But once people stopped getting raises, credit cards started filling that gap. And there's a chart I show where you lay over credit card debt over the falling, over the stagnant wages for American workers over the last 50 years. And the credit card debt perfectly makes up this gap. You know, right now there's $1 trillion in outstanding credit card debt in America. So for the people on top, they realized that it was far more profitable to make people borrow their raises and pay interest on them than it would be to pay them. And this level of thinking is what's driven everything. This is why everything's become financialized, why student loan debt is so high, because college is 19 times more expensive than it used to be. There's just all these choices that we look at and just don't make sense to us as a human being, as a citizen. It doesn't make sense to us. And so, you know, I believe the perspective that it does make sense by is if we consider the fact that every choice is being made according to this one criteria of the what is the highest financial outcome. I think that's changeable. I think that's very changeable.
Well, I guess I think of it in terms of, you know, the reason I asked the question about sort of politics and an election is because, you know, we've been watching Trevor Noah, you know, and people apparently, like, Wall Street is shitting bricks over Elizabeth Warren, you know, constantly. And Jamie Dimon, the CEO of Citibank, was just like, oh, she's vilifying billionaires. And, I mean, it was just an interesting perspective. But I wonder, I mean, you mentioned student loan debt, so I didn't want to get out of this without talking to you about that because, you know, I have a student loan debt that I remember we had Andrew Yang here, and I feel like this is like an insurmountable mountain. Like it's just not going to happen unless I get really rich. Like that's, you know, the honest truth.
Yep.
And I asked him, am I alone here? He said, no. He said, it's you and millions of people in the exact same situation. He said that he thought that his student loans, he felt like were so big that he felt like he had a mistress and another family because that's how big the checks were for law school. So I wonder, I used to joke that I was like, I wonder if we could Kickstarter like the end of student loan debt. But then you have this sort of paradox at play of self-interest. Like people, unfortunately, are, you know, driven by so much self-interest, as we've seen from the people who are at the top. Like, why is it that we have this sort of self-interest driven way of doing things and we're not, you know, like I said, I think the way that you wrote this book, like, I thought, wow, this is a very utopian and idealistic view of the world, which I love. And then part of me has the doubts that I do based on the questions that I just asked.
Yeah, well, I think that the political structure is a big reason why financial maximization has just so effectively run the show. You know, there's been a lot of changes in regulation. You know, just the way our society has been governed has really shifted hard in the favor of like the 0.1%. So I think that hearts and minds can change, but there has to be a political component of this change as well. I noticed just a couple of weeks ago, it was the person who was working for Betsy DeVos in the Department of Education, who was responsible for taking in student loan payments. He quit the Trump administration and said that instead proposed that all student loans should be wiped away and that everyone who has paid their student loans back before should get a tax credit up to $50,000 to account for the debt they've repaid in the past.
Yeah.
And so this coming from a Republican leader is meaningful. The fact that he had to quit his job where it was his job to do this, to say this is frightening. But you know, there's the saying about how only Nixon could go to China. Like there's this kind of like, if you pursue policies that are too in line with your ideological beliefs, it's difficult. It's harder to achieve. But if you're doing it sort of across party lines, it's weirdly more possible. So I think the wiping away student debt that might happen. I mean, Bernie Elizabeth Warren really put that on the table, and there's not a good argument for it. Now there is a counter proposal in the House of Representatives when the Republicans had control, which is about mandatory garnishment of wages for people's student loans, which is just insanity. This is an example of how just the order of our society really, really doesn't work and really produces a quite like an outcome I can't imagine anyone really desires unless you are one of those student loan companies or you own their stock. But yet that is the only criteria through which we're making these choices.
Well, I remember watching this documentary with this Matt Damon documentary. I don't remember what it was called. It was about the financial crisis. And it was, you know, one of the CEOs was like one of the lenders of these students. It was either Fannie Mae
or Inside Job. Mac. Inside Job. It was called.
Inside Job. And I was like, this guy took a $90 million bonus when they took a $1 billion loss. I'm like, fuck that guy. I'll pay my minimum payment. That was my attitude.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, forgive my vulgarity, but that's just kind of the way I felt about it. I don't think I'm alone in feeling that.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, yeah. I mean, this is we just get so protectionist. We get so protectionist over what we have. There's a human nature part of it. Even though that money is meaningless to that person, really it's meaningless. It's a proxy for self-esteem. It's that important because they are so unhappy in other ways. You know, I feel like there's a line in Sapiens where Yuval Harari says that, like, we thought we tamed wheat, but wheat tamed us. Well, you know, rich people think they've tamed capital, but capital has enslaved them. You know, the idea that the only choices that are possible are ones that produce a return that beats the S&P index is crazy. But for the wealthiest people in the world, that yes, they live lives of luxury. Yes, they have all these things, but all their choices fundamentally come down to like a math problem. And, you know, when I've been like doing book stuff over the last few weeks, I found myself in rooms with more wealthy and powerful people than I'm used to. And I'm seizing those opportunities to talk about this. And the big thing I keep trying to ask people is, can you imagine a world in which investing financial value to create non-financial value is like a rational thing to do? You know, if you spend money, you're not going to get a financial return, but say you're going to get a return in terms of awareness or future sustainability, or, you know, the planet going through less harm, or the social cohesiveness of human beings being greater. Could I make a case to you that spending money on that is like a highly profitable thing to do? And you know, I get looks of real confusion. To me, it feels like there's a synapse missing, because it's like talking to very smart people who are, you know, very well educated, but you propose this idea of, let's use financial capital to create non-financial capital. And I want to make the case to you that that's actually the single best thing we could do, you know, because at the same time, these people are talking about how there's trillions of dollars sitting out of the markets because wealthy people, there aren't enough places to make enough money off with them that it's worth spending it. Meanwhile, the world burns.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the world burns, and we wonder why, right? Mm-hmm. And so we've been trapped by this notion that the only use of financial value is to create more financial value. So the only human activities that are allowed to move forward are ones that have a high probability of producing a minimum of a maximum financial outcome.
Hi, I'm Roshan. I've been listening to the podcast for the past 4 years now. I find the quality and diversity of guests on it is really hard to match. There's even a few conversations from around 3 years ago that hit me so hard, like the interviews of Ted Rice, Rima Zaman, and Dave Munson, just to name a few, that I can remember exactly where I was and what I was doing when I was listening to them. I joined the Unmistakable Tribe on the Mighty Networks app because I thought it would be a chance to meet other listeners. It's definitely been that, but it's also been a lot more. People share their stories and their amazing work on the app, which is a real source of inspiration to me. It just helps to remind me of all that's possible when you persist with a creative habit, whether or not you're famous. Also, I think being a part of the tribe feels quite different to being on Facebook. On Facebook, I find that too many posts leave me with a sense of feeling less than, or frankly, just don't interest me. With the tribe, though, I just check in to see if there are any posts that look interesting to me, and then I just leave without spending ages on it. Using the app is a simple way to connect with other human beings who have similar interests, as well as learn about cool stuff. Recently, for example, Milena, the lovely community manager, set up a co-working meetup. I tried it out for a task I'd been putting off, and I found it to be really productive. If it sounds like your kind of thing, I definitely recommend trying it out. You have nothing to lose. Look forward to seeing you there.
Just visit unmistakablecreative.com/tribe to sign up and learn more. And I look forward to seeing you inside our new Mighty Network.
I think that, you know, you talk about the trap, you know, you have an entire chapter where you talk about life goals, role models, and, you know, sort of being scared successful. And I think I loved, you know, the study you quoted about the UCLA students where some exorbitant percentage of them wanted to be rich. And I, you know, it's funny because you talk to like younger people, some ridiculous amount of them want to be famous because of social media. So, you know, one thing you did say,
I think that's changed, right? Because there was the, I forget the rapper was the line that was so big, but like, you know, they be making memes, I be making millions, you know? So yeah. I think we've switched back from fame to wealth again, but yes.
Yeah. So, you know, one thing you say is when we base our idea of success on external motivators, we enter a race without a finish line. There's no winning, only the race. And, you know, so it was so strange for me to, because I was taking my notes on your book this morning. And earlier this morning I wrote, you know, there's these four words that basically are the root of all of our suffering. And that's all be happy when. And, you know, then I came across that line and I thought, you know, like, who are we kidding? Every one of us has this sort of idealized version of who we are that only exists in the future when we have more money, when we have, you know, the romantic partner, whatever it is. Do you feel that you've resolved that paradox in your life? Like, do you feel like there's still another goalpost? Because Ryan Holiday, you know, was just here. He hit the New York Times bestseller with the latest book. It was the eighth book. But one of the things he said is like, no amount of accomplishment is going to make you feel as good as you think you are.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think on like the macro level, I think I feel good about where I am. You know, I have a family that I feel very in tuned with, and like I'm devoting my time to like intellectual things. And that is like, I don't know. It's luxurious. It's most connected to my truest self. It's, you know, so like on the macro level, I mean, you know, pretty amazing, pretty amazing. The 2 years since leaving Kickstarter, pretty amazing, not easy, but amazing. On a minute to minute level, all over the place. I'm all over the place. You know, it's like, you know, this is my first book, and I don't even want to say how many times a day or a week I like look at my Amazon rating, right? And I had a day last week where I'd like, many amazing things were happening. I was in Portugal being a part of a really great event, and it, you know, I was really excited about it. And that morning I like looked at my Amazon rating, which was okay. And then in the lead up to the book, I start to look at who are people that have books coming out around the same time as me. And then you form your cohort. And so of course, after I felt good about my book, then I had to go and look at like the three other books that I think of as like in the same vein as me.
And Simon Sinek, I'm guessing.
Yeah. And they were all doing better. And so like, literally I'm like walking to this thing and I'm just feeling terrible about myself. I'm just like this. I mean, I felt it in a lead up to the book too, right? You spend months like pitching op-eds everywhere. And the New York Times had expressed interest in an op-ed and they invited me to write it. And I wrote it and then I didn't hear anything for 3 weeks. And then they said no. Mm-hmm. And honestly, if I'd had the choice to pull the plug on the book at that moment, like there's a part of me that would have done it. Cause I just thought I'm already a failure.
Well, I can relate. It's funny because I wrote an entire book where this was the primary message of the book. It was called An Audience of One, Reclaiming Creativity for Its Own Sake. I should send it to you because I have, I wrote about this, like the Amazon things. I almost never look at my Amazon rankings anymore because I'm like, this is a recipe for insanity, as you've just learned. And yeah, I totally relate to that. It's one of those things that I think is extremely hard to do, particularly because it's not like you do this thing and think, oh, you know what? I don't care whether it reaches a lot of people, but it's, you know, there's always somebody who I think is ahead.
Well, I had to reach, Simon Sinek's book is not one of the books. I wouldn't even dream of competing with Simon, but his book is great. His book is great on this idea, the infinite game, finite and infinite games is quite good. My book came out 2.5 weeks ago. I would say the first 2 weeks were just nothing but like, ego notifications, ego notification disease. And I finally got home, you know, a couple days ago and had a day of like still having that sickness. And then, you know, and then finally had a day where I connected with why I wrote the book. Which I wrote it in part for people to read it, but I also wrote it because I believe in these larger changes, and I feel the need to create an institution that's trying to do this. And, you know, I was sort of like, okay, so now I just need to get back to my plan. I need to get back to my plan. And like, the book is part of the plan, but it's not the whole thing. And, and, you know, I'm like talking to people, I'm trying to do the things so that people can really hear this. And I, you know, I really have to live like the Bentoist ideals that my book promotes, and really try to balance this now me, this now me that makes me identify with, like I saw the other day, the day before the impeachment trial started, Donald Trump tweeted like 82 times in a day, which works out to about every 15 minutes. So I think that process was probably he tweets, then he spends 15 minutes looking at the notifications of like what people said in response. And then he tweets, he starts it again every 15 minutes. Yeah. And I recognize that's what he's doing. Cause like, I would love to do that. Right. There's a part of you, there's a part of you that's like, let me find my inner Gary V that just like, no fear, no, whatever. Like, look at me, look at me. I deserve it. Look at me. And like, that is in me. That is in me. Now when I allow that part of myself to speak, I like, if I don't instantly regret it, I regret it a couple hours later, you know, but it's there, it's there. And so, but like, I have to balance that with the future me of knowing who I want to be, of knowing what's important. And I also need to balance it with like thinking about other human beings who probably don't just want to hear me shouting, look at me, over and over all day. Like, that's probably not cool for other folks. So I try to ground those feelings in a larger context of myself. And that lets me like love those things about myself, humor them, you know, like not feel ashamed of them, be more like, oh, you know, yeah, we really do need that, don't we? But like, it's okay. You don't, that doesn't mean you have to do it, you know? But it's such a battle.
Wow. Well, I mean, I think you kind of teed up the whole idea of Bentoism, and you kind of introduced us to the sort of now me, now us, future me and future us in what you just said. So let's talk about the idea of Bentoism. What is it? And then, you know, kind of go into Bento values, which you defined as scarcity, autonomy, community, fairness, and tradition.
Yeah. So I was sitting here at my desk, same place I'm sitting right now, one day, and I just was like, I drew a hockey stick graph. You know, I was trying to, during the book, while writing, I had 3 weeks that I'd work on the computer, and then I would have 1 week off where I would do nothing on the computer, and I would just read and cut out a printout of what I'd written over the previous 3 weeks, or I would just draw. Like I would storyboard a chapter. I would just try to do different things just to like loosen my brain up. And so I happened to doodle a hockey stick graph, a chart where the line just goes up and to the right. And as I was looking at it, it occurred to me that the two axes of that graph actually like kept going, that the x-axis of a hockey stick graph of our self-interest, it goes from now all the way into the future. It extends farther out to the right. And the y-axis, measuring whatever it is we're trying to grow, whatever our self-interest actually is, it also keeps going. It keeps going from me. And then as it grows, it goes to us. Like I thought about the experience of being single versus having a family, or being a solo entrepreneur and then having employees, like how big those gaps are. And so I like drew this like sort of bigger chart, and suddenly this hockey stick graph was just like a tiny slice of this bigger picture. And I sort of drew some lines on it to make it into four quadrants. And I thought, okay, so our self-interest isn't just this like one space, it's these other spaces, but like, what is this a chart of? And I wanted to try to describe it. So I wrote on the piece of paper, this is beyond near-term orientation. Like it was a way to see longer term. And as I looked at that phrase, I realized that that was an acronym that said Bento. And I thought, oh shit, this is a Bento box. These are four compartments of a Bento box. And just like 2 weeks before, my wife had shown me this book that had mentioned the bento box and talked about how the bento honors the Japanese dieting philosophy of hadahachi bu, which says the goal of a meal is to be 80% full. That way you're still hungry for tomorrow. So I thought, oh, bentoism, like a bento box for our values, for our self-interest, our choices. It's a way to not just maximize for right now. It's a way to be hungry for tomorrow. It's a way to really see our full self-interest. So in that bento, there is in the bottom left corner where the hockey stick graph is, that's our now me, what I want and need right now. And the bottom right corner of the bento is future me, the older, wiser version of ourself that we want to become, the person that lives the obituary we hope we deserve to have. And the top left is now us, the people that we rely on, who rely on us, our friends, our families, our coworkers. And then the top right is future us, our children and everybody else's children too. So the book argues that every choice we make impacts all of these spaces. It's not just about now me. And all these spaces factor into all of our choices. However, because of our limited way of seeing our self-interest today, we see now me as rational, and we see everything else as kind of emotional and not as real. And so we struggle to make good decisions thinking about the future. We struggle to make good decisions thinking about other people because we have been conditioned to believe that those things are somehow less real than just our me selves. And so Bentoism is a personal philosophy that I've been teaching in workshops and just sort of putting it in people's hands, helping people build their bentos, find their values, use it to make self-coherent choices. I talk a lot about being self-coherent. And then I think the longer-term project of Bentoism is to use this case that our self-interest is bigger than just now me, use that as a platform to define new rational values, basically to combine to create values that will compete with financial value so that when a CEO is facing a decision that will have a clear financial outcome and maybe will have a what is today an unclear environmental outcome, what if that decision could be put in a place where both of those outcomes were the same level of clear and both run a sort of a rational playing field, level playing field, whereas today money is the rational choice and everything else is just this sort of feeling stuff that we really only act on in moments of crisis when we feel like we have to apologize. Yeah. And so what is the world where those things can be on the same playing field? How do we make future generations, how do we make it less difficult to make good choices? And so I think that's a process that takes a long time. I think that's like a decades long process. That involves a lot of research and working with organizations, like really feeling the real world implications of this. But I am like deeply convinced that the shift in perspective that allows us to evolve and allows us to begin repairing the world is to expand how we see self-interest and expand how we see value, because that lets us apply the things that human beings are so good at: optimizing, growing, collaborating to create things, and allows us to direct that energy towards, you know, collective goals, ones that are not just about growing our own wealth, which is basically we have all these amazing tools and we're using them for the lamest reason possible right now. And so can that be changed? Is that a pressure point that can be changed?
Yeah. So I wonder, I mean, you'd mentioned earlier, like you've gotten to talk to a lot of very wealthy people. Are any of them even remotely open to this, or do they just see it as utopian, socialist, and crazy?
Largely utopian, socialist, and crazy. But but you know, I had an interesting conversation the other day where I was talking to a group of people along these lines at a dinner table, and they pushed back on my theory. They said, you know, our companies are not financially maximizing. We just are making good decisions that happen to produce big financial outcomes, you know, but it's not that money is the only important thing. Like, that's really an exaggeration. And like the second this part of the conversation happens, a new person sits down to join, and he's the CEO of an outdoors company. And so we start talking and learn that he's like, is a private equity guy who's running this company. He doesn't really use the products that the company makes, but he's been leading it for a while. Yeah. And so I pose this question to him: hey, can you imagine someone putting a rational argument in front of you that would say that the single most important thing you could do for the prosperity of your company 10 years from now is to invest heavily in R&D of sustainable products, you know, changing your carbon emissions, because, you know, otherwise the pastime that you support like might really disappear in 10 years. You know, people might not be able to do that anymore at all. So like, could you imagine, you know, someone making that case to you and you going, you know, and you sort of operating on that, investing money to produce non-financial outcomes that will ultimately result in, you know, a continued prosperity down the line. But the point is not a financial return. And again, it was like this broken synapse. And he kept saying, I see what you're trying to do here. And that's what he just kept saying over and over. And I kept trying to put this in different ways. And he just wouldn't connect. It wouldn't connect. And after this conversation stopped, I looked at the other people who had been arguing with me just a moment before, saying that my theory was not true. And I could see that they understood what I meant. And that, you know, the notion of why can't we use money to grow things other than money? Suddenly that, like, they could see why that was actually maybe a pretty good question to ask. So, you know, I think I can I think I can evolve how people think. I mean, generally the way I try to talk to people is I imagine I'm like, it's because what I would want, I crawl into someone's bubble with them. I lock eyes with them. I make sure that we both feel safe and comfortable. And then while we're locking eyes and talking, I'm very slowly shifting their bubble in another direction. And by the time we stop talking and we look around, we've both moved. We both moved like 5 yards. And so they're in a different place than they were before. And they didn't feel like their opinion was changing. They didn't, you know, they're just sort of nodding along, agreeing with what this person was saying to them. But what they're surprised to find is that the impact of that has left them in a different place than they were before. Yeah. And so that happens. That happens because the negative emotions, the worries, the concerns, those are things we all share, and we try to quiet them. We try to justify them. We try to rationalize them, or we pretend like they have to be here. And, you know, that ability to try to make the things that don't make sense, try to allow them to make sense, try to explain like, actually, you know, every system works to produce the outcome it produces, you know, yeah. It's just like, we're not being honest about it. And so, yeah, those conversations make me think that that we're not really aware of what we're doing, and gaining that awareness is a surprising moment for people. I think the example of the NBA in Hong Kong is another case where we had believed that spreading economic value would mean the growth of American values. And suddenly we face this question of what does it mean if like America's economic values and say a value like free speech are actually not aligned? What if those things are in conflict the way we're currently thinking about it? And how does that mean that we should order our value system? And so like that's a level of confrontation that our society has not faced in a long time. Wow. And I think there are going to be more of those things. They will add up, and they will require the need for a new way of defining and thinking about value that will allow us to act with some coherence and to not feel like the world is just breaking. And so I think that moment is coming. And so I think the pessimistic, optimistic take would be that you need a crisis to produce change, to create a solution. And I root for soft crises. But you know, we're in a place where almost half of Americans can't afford their bills every month. So it's more just a crisis that we've gotten used to, that we become comfortably numb to. But, you know, problems create solutions. Solutions don't create themselves on their own.
Wow. This has been really, really amazing. I mean, to me, this is one of those things that like I have to probably play back 100 times just to kind of think through everything you've said. I mean, like I said, I think to me, the most eye-opening thing about the book was it made you think. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
You know, I think it's, I think it comes down to like an unusual value set. You know, it's like when someone has one thing, but also has another thing that you wouldn't totally associate. This is the most inane place to go, but it's just what came to mind. I'm not a regular watcher of the YouTube series Hot Ones, where people eat hot wings, but I watched the Shia LaBeouf one. I've always been a Shia LaBeouf fan, and I was just curious, like, what kind of guy is he? And he just had this amazing combination of like this, you know, kind of gruff John Wayne hyper masculinity paired with like this true tenderness and I don't know, emotional maturity, to where it was just like just such an evolved man. And to me, it was like having this combination of values, being like a, you know, hyper macho in some way, but also just the antithesis of that in another way. I think this is why we love The Rock so much. But I think, yeah, it's just when those combinations come together in a way that we weren't expecting. And the other thing I think that makes people unmistakable, and this is probably just the one that's it's often unexpected, is just true honesty. You know, as a CEO, I write in the book about how you meet other CEOs and everyone's like, how are things going? And everyone's just saying, but you wouldn't believe how good it is. Like, even better. I'm doing even better than that guy's doing. And it's just like that level of conversation. And I used to participate in that. And at a certain point, I stopped. Instead, I would just be really honest. How's everything going today? yeah, today's brutal, you know, as all days are as a CEO. Like, it's a brutal day. And then you just see who's willing to be honest back with you. And, you know, and people that are amazing. And those are connections you make. And then people who can't get there, you're just like, oh, you know, that's tough. That's tough that you can't do that. You know, I wish for you that in the next moment that you can be honest with somebody, because it's like way, you know, way more rewarding. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your wisdom and your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and the book?
Yeah, I'm, you know, the book is called This Could Be Our Future, A Manifesto for a More Generous World. I could be found online at ystrickler.com, ystrickler.com. And then for Bentoism, there's a site I love so much that I made with a friend called bentoism.org. And there you go through like an online workshop that teaches you how to build a bento, teaches you how to make self-coherent choices. And then you can also sign up to be notified of workshops and things like that, which I'm going to keep doing both face-to-face and like online. So if listeners are interested in getting more into bentoism, would love that. That would be awesome.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here, like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.